Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Good evening and welcome to the History of Alchemy podcast. This is a special episode because I actually went to Munich to hunt down Peter Adamson, who's a professor at the LMU in Munich, and also, of course, the host of the History of Philosophy podcast Without Any Gaps, who we've mentioned a couple of times. So welcome to the show, Peter. Thanks for having me here in your office.
Oh, thanks. It's great to be on the History of Alchemy.
Yeah, so today we wanted to go over Neoplatonism because we've mentioned it a lot on the show. It seems like almost every episode. And I thought, who better to ask about it than you? So to get things started, I think for our listeners that don't know, maybe we can kind of talk about Platonism first and talk about what Platonism was and then maybe talk about the differences.
Right. So obviously, Platonism could just refer to the ideas and doctrines, if there were any doctrines, of Plato, who's one of the great philosophers of all time and who lived numerous centuries before the Neoplatonists, because Neoplatonism doesn't get started until the 3rd century AD.
Right.
And actually, what we have from Plato isn't a body of treatises with doctrines, such as we have from, say, Aristotle, or in fact from most of the Neoplatonists. We have dialogues. And famously, in most of these dialogues, you have Socrates interacting with other characters, and they're arguing about various things like how to define one of the virtues or what is justice, things like that. And the Neoplatonists thought, and some people still think today, that you can go into the dialogues and extract philosophical positions. This is more plausible with respect to some dialogues than others. So with some of the earlier dialogues, the things Plato wrote towards the beginning of his career, which are sometimes called Socratic dialogues, they're much more open-ended. There's no resolution. The characters sort of try to define courage or something, make several attempts, and then they fail and agree that it would be good to go on looking. You don't really get the sense that you're being told what the answer is.
Right.
Whereas in a dialogue like The Republic, which is Plato's masterpiece, they're talking about justice and why it's better to be just than unjust. And Socrates puts forward a lot of very confident theories. So the Neoplatonists are most attracted to the dialogues of Plato, in which Plato seems, in fact, to be putting forward more ambitious philosophical theories. And within that, they were attracted especially to some dialogues that are not read as frequently today. So if you go to university and study Plato as an undergraduate philosophy student, for example, you probably would study some of the Socratic dialogues. You'd probably read The Republic and so on, probably read the Meno, the Phaedo. And these were certainly read by the Neoplatonists, and they even wrote commentaries on them. But there were some other dialogues that they really loved. One that's very difficult to understand, called the Parmenides, which is this very abstract kind of logical exercise about the nature of unity and being. There's another one called the Timaeus, which is probably the most important Platonic dialogue for alchemy, because that's the one where Plato talks about the universe having been created by a demiurge or divine craftsman. And he also gives a theory about the four elements and how they're constructed. And as maybe I can say later, that it turns out to be a kind of atomism forward there. So in a way, he gives you the physical basis for understanding how alchemy could work. Most of the Neoplatonists are not alchemists. But Neoplatonism, as you've said in a lot of your shows, is very influential on alchemy. And the alchemists are often referring to the kind of metaphysical picture that you get in Neoplatonism. And the Neoplatonists, in turn, were extracting that metaphysical picture from Platonism. So the things that we most of all associate with Plato's metaphysics would be the most obvious thing, the theory of forms. So the theory of forms is actually not nearly as prominent in the dialogues as you might think.
Okay.
So I think before people read Plato, they think, oh, he's going to be kind of talking about the forms all over the place. Mm-hmm. And actually, it turns out that although there are passages where he talks about forms, he very rarely makes any attempt to tell you what they are.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
He very rarely tries to convince you that there are such things.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, they usually come in as a kind of hypothesis for answering some other philosophical question. So he might be trying to explain how words get their meaning.
Mm-hmm.
He might be trying to explain what the basis of ethics is. He might be trying to explain how knowledge is possible. And then he'll refer to these forms without actually explaining to you what they are.
Okay, yeah.
And interestingly, one of the clearest passages for understanding what the forms are comes in the beginning of this dialogue, the Parmenides, that I mentioned. And what happens there is that he has a young Socrates meeting an old Parmenides, the great pre-Socratic philosopher, and he has Parmenides attack the theory of forms and refute it. And along the way, he has Socrates say what he thinks the forms are, these abstract paradigms.
Yeah.
So the idea is that if something is large, then like an elephant, say, it becomes large by participating or being a similitude of the form of large.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one thing, the theory of forms. Other things include the immortality of the soul, the fact that the universe is well designed, possibly by this divine craftsman that we find in the Timaeus, and more generally, a kind of view according to which the things that are more real and more central in philosophy and more the objects of our knowledge tend to be things that are not material and bodily,
mm-hmm.
but rather immaterial, transcendent things, i.e. forms, gods,
mm-hmm.
like the demiurge, and the soul. And that is what the Neoplatonists are going to pick up and run with.
Yeah, okay. And so how did... So first of all, I guess Neoplatonists would have just called themselves Platonists.
Absolutely,
but,
yeah.
So what are some of the other differences that maybe they... Like, what did they add to Neoplatonism that is not in the original, that Plato had nothing to do with?
Yeah, well, I think it's actually worth emphasizing what you just said, which is that they thought of themselves as just Platonists,
mm-hmm.
who were offering a kind of exegesis of the doctrines of Plato,
mm-hmm.
in the way I described. So they're sort of pulling out the doctrines and formulating a systematic theory,
mm-hmm.
on the basis of some dialogues. And in fact, even within their favorite dialogues, there are some passages they really like.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
So the phrase Neoplatonism comes only in the last couple of centuries.
Right.
So in modern scholarship. And it was originally kind of an insult. So the idea is there was like the old Platonists, who are
mm-hmm.
Plato and his immediate followers, and there's the so-called middle Platonists,
mm-hmm.
who are people who come along around the early Roman Empire. And they're very influenced by Pythagoreanism.
Yep.
But they start having this metaphysical interpretation of Plato. And then the Neoplatonists carry that on. In fact, nowadays, there are even some scholars who don't want to use the word Neoplatonism anymore because
mm-hmm.
they think it's pejorative.
Okay.
I kind of think we're stuck with it, so we should keep using it. But the other thing that I think now would be very widely recognized is that Plotinus, who's considered to be the first Neoplatonist, is not just coming out of nowhere doing something that no one has thought to do with Plato before, i.e. have this highly metaphysical and also ethically loaded and doctrinal reading
mm-hmm.
of Plato. Rather, he's in a way just the next in a long line of Platonists who begin right with Plato's students and immediate successors, Chrysippus and Xenocrates. And then you can go all the way up to these middle Platonists. And for a while, the Platonic Academy went skeptical. And so they
mm-hmm.
don't have this doctrinal reading of Plato. But then with the middle Platonists and Plotinus, you get more and more this temptation to read Plato as a doctrinal philosopher, and also to combine Plato with other philosophical movements like Stoicism and Aristotelianism.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So one way of thinking about Plotinus is that he's just the most influential and successful of a line of Platonists who are weaving other philosophical ideas into the dialogues of Plato and reading Plato in a doctrinal way and putting a lot of emphasis on certain ideas, namely the ones I just mentioned. So
mm-hmm.
the importance of transcendent metaphysical entities, the importance of being systematic, and maybe the most important thing of all, the derivation of all things from a completely unified first principle, And that's maybe the thing that's most distinctive about Neoplatonism. If you were going to put your finger on just one thing, like what's new about Neoplatonism, it's not the immortality of the soul, because that's been in Platonism right along. It's not the forms, that's been in Neoplatonism all along. And there were even Jewish Platonists like Philo of Alexandria who thought there were forms that are ideas in the mind of God, right?
Mm-hmm. I remember that from your podcast.
Yeah, right. It was the two podcasts sort of influencing one another. So what I think, if you were going to say, I mean, there's lots of things that are distinctive about the Neoplatonists in general and Plotinus in particular, but maybe the thing that is more distinctive than anything else is the idea of a supreme, ineffable first principle. And the way is prepared for that by earlier Platonists, but Plotinus really explores that and develops this very distinctive hierarchical system with the one at the top.
Yep. Okay. And is that, would it be wrong to say that Neoplatonism is trying to, I mean, you kind of mentioned that it's kind of, is trying to make Aristotle fit with Plato. Is that fair to say? I mean, how does Aristotle fit in with Neoplatonism?
Yeah, well, in a way, that's a little bit controversial, actually.
Oh, okay.
So
yeah.
Plotinus had a student named Porphyry, and Porphyry edited the works of Plotinus. So when we read Plotinus, we read this set of his treatises called the Enneads, which means nines. Porphyry basically did an edition of Plotinus's works, in which he grouped them into six sets of nine treatises, hence the Enneads. And he wrote a work called The Life of Plotinus, in which he talks about what kind of guy Plotinus was and tells some interesting anecdotes about him. And he says it's various things about Plotinus's works. And one of the things he says is that if you look at Aristotle, you'll find all of Aristotle's teachings kind of scattered through Plotinus.
Okay, yeah.
So that's basically right, in the sense that Plotinus uses a lot of Aristotle's ideas. So just one example would be that at the top of Plotinus's system, you have this supreme, ineffable, totally unified principle, the one. And the thing that comes after that is an intellect, which is thinking about all the forms. So it's kind of like Philo of Alexandria's God, right? So you've got this divine intellect, which is grasping the forms. And for Plotinus, who's not reacting to Philo, Plotinus is thinking of that, at least to some extent, as Aristotle's God. So Aristotle's God is a self-thinking intellect. Plotinus's intellect is doing very much the same thing. It's thinking about its own thought, which turns out to be all the forms, the Platonic forms. But within that, there's a critique of Aristotle, right? Because he's saying, well, yes, you're right that there is this divine intellect, which somehow gives rise to the rest of the universe and makes it move in an orderly fashion. He agrees with Aristotle about all that. He agrees that this divine intellect is thinking about its own thoughts, but he denies that it's the first principle. And the reason he gives is that the first principle should be something that's completely one, because unity is what makes everything the thing that it is, like you're one human. And so there's a principle of unity in you that makes you what you are. And you could sort of think about it as like a super Platonic form. It's the form that gives everything else the possibility of existing by giving it unity. And he says, well, if you had this kind of super form, which was a pure unity, that can't be an intellect, because an intellect is multiple, right? It has many ideas.
Okay,
and
yeah.
Even if you didn't worry about the fact that it has many ideas, he has a very interesting point, which is that if this intellect is thinking about itself, then it must have a kind of duality, because it's both the thing that's thinking and it's the thing that's being thought about. So even though it's one thing thinking about itself, it's still two. It's the thing that thinks and the thing that is thought. So he denies that this intellect could be the first principle. And that's very characteristic. So what they tend to do, the Neoplatonists with Aristotle, is they tend to accept some of his ideas and then say that these ideas don't go far enough in a Platonist direction. And in fact, what you see happening in the rest of antiquity, and this is not so relevant to alchemy, but it's worth touching on briefly, is that the Platonists effectively think of Aristotle as kind of introductory level philosophy, especially Aristotle's logic. So if you turn up in a philosophy class in Alexandria in the 5th century, say, what will happen is you'll have a Platonist professor, and the professor will start you off on Aristotle's logic and natural philosophy. And then if you kind of stick around to do your doctorate, you'll graduate to working on Plato. So they think of Aristotle as a kind, as definitely a great philosopher, and as a, in some ways a, an inspired divine philosopher, although not as inspired as Plato.
Yeah.
But they think that Aristotle doesn't look as high as Plato in some ways, or at least that he, his philosophy isn't relevant to the highest principles. So he just they just think that he doesn't have very much to say about, for example, the realm of intellect. Rather, he's concentrating more on logic and physics.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. I remember in your podcast, you mentioned that, you basically mentioned that they would start with Aristotle's logic or something, and then, and so you pointed out that, so you could have a pagan teacher, and then some of the students might be Christian, because they start with just something that's more kind of neutral, and start with, you know, philosophy in general, or, I mean, with Aristotle, and then when they start moving up, then they start thinking about higher beings and this kind of thing. So is it also fair to say that Neoplatonists, that their idea of the one and all the gods that are below them, that it got more complicated over time as they kind of thought about how that works, or the nature of gods and that kind of thing?
The listener can't see that I'm nodding, but I'm nodding, right? So, so a good contrast here, and this is to some extent a cliche, but it's close enough to being right, is that you have Plotinus, who has a relatively simple version of Neoplatonism. So his system, you have this ineffable one at the top, then you have the nous, or intellect, which is identical with the realm of forms, which are the things it's thinking about. Then you have the soul, which is the level of both our soul and the soul of the entire universe.
Is that the nous, or is that something else?
No, nous is intellect.
Okay, yep.
And
all right.
Soul is psyche, which is where we get the word psychology, right? And then the soul is responsible for bringing form into matter. So you've effectively got the one at the top, then nous, or intellect, then soul, then the material world with shape and form being given to it by the soul, taking the ideas from nous and putting it into matter. Okay, so that's quite simple. I mean, well, you might think it's quite weird, but it's not complicated, right?
Sure.
You've only got four levels. If you then go ahead several generations, you get to Proclus, who's really notorious for having a very complicated version of the same system. And this is a bit of a long story, but basically what he does is he generates a lot more levels within the system by invoking various laws of causation. So maybe the most important is that between any two principles, you will have a mean principle, sort of like between two numbers, like between four and six, there'd be five. So wherever he thinks there's room for another principle, where there could be a kind of compromise between the two principles, there will be that. So, for example, between intellect and soul, you'd have intellective souls.
That's
a simple example. And he also thinks that every level of the hierarchy will have its own supreme principle, which creates a series of beings or entities. And that starts already with the one. So the one is, as in Plotinus, this completely supreme, ineffable principle. And it generates not just the intellect, but also a whole range of unities, which he calls henads. And these can be identified with the gods of pagan religion. So this way of changing the Neoplatonic system, which actually goes back to an earlier thinker named Iamblichus, who's a little bit less famous, but it may be important for you because he has all these ideas about theurgy. One way of thinking about what Iamblichus and then later Proclus are doing is that they're making the system complicated enough to accommodate pagan religion. So whereas in Plotinus, if you ask Plotinus, well, what's Zeus? He'll say, oh, well, it's just my intellect. Whereas if you ask Proclus, well, who's Hera or who's Poseidon? He can point to some particular element of his system. He can also explain to you what the names of the gods mean and how they're a kind of exposition of the underlying metaphysics. And so he has a metaphysical picture which is supposed to be a kind of rational demonstration of the truth represented by pagan religion. One way of explaining this development is that whereas Plotinus is writing in the 3rd century when the empire is still pagan,
mm-hmm.
and the pagans are pretty confident in their religious beliefs. Proclus is writing at a time when the empire has been taken over by Christianity, right? Mm-hmm. It's after Constantine. And in fact, at his time, the pagans are really on the run mm-hmm. and are in some ways being oppressed mm-hmm. by the Christians. And he's effectively turning around to his society and saying, oh, you know, these religious traditions and beliefs that you just spent a couple of centuries overturning and now violently persecuting, I will use reason to show mm-hmm. you that they're actually true.
Yep.
So that was a big mistake, and we need to go back to the old ways. Mm-hmm. So it's in a way, it's a kind of technical, highly professionalized philosophical version
mm-hmm.
of the kind of thing that Augustine is responding to in the City of God. So Augustine mentions that there were these pagans who said that the reason Rome was sacked was because they gave up on the old gods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Proclus is saying, he's saying the reason that you have all these false metaphysical beliefs is that you gave up on the true gods of our mm-hmm. fathers and forefathers.
That's interesting, yeah. So Peter, to kind of bring it a step closer to alchemy, let's say, is there any kind of mystical aspects you can talk about with Neoplatonism? You know, if you know what I mean, how would you say, is it a mystical religion or is it a mystical thought?
Well, so I think actually this is one reason people connect alchemy to
mm-hmm.
Neoplatonism, both in the popular imagination and also historically. There are these connections. And in fact, there's a, to the extent that there's a kind of man on the street view of Neoplatonism, it's that it's this kind of mystical
yeah.
tradition. And what I would say is that although there is a kind of place where mysticism comes in Platonism, in general, it's very not mystical.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the kind of surprising thing to say about Neoplatonism, so okay. I should explain
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So if you think about what both Proclus and Plotinus were doing, what they wanted to say is that you can extract a rational system from the teachings of Plato,
mm-hmm.
maybe informed by Aristotle and the Stoics,
mm-hmm.
and that system, in a sense, culminates not with this first principle, the one, but with nous,
mm-hmm.
the
okay.
intellect,
yeah.
because that's the world of forms. And they would say that although intellect doesn't think discursively or use language the mm-hmm. way that we do as souls,
yeah.
for them, intellect epitomizes what rationality is. So they will compare it, for example, to a mathematical system.
Mm-hmm.
They're very Pythagorean,
yep, right.
so they'll compare it to the system of numbers, but also Plotinus, when he talks about the contents of nous, he does things like comparing it to a theorem and then all of the things that kind of derive from it in mathematics,
mm-hmm.
or an axiom and the mm-hmm. derivatives of the axiom. So there's a kind of, I think, a fundamental misunderstanding about Neoplatonism, which is that they think the point of philosophy is to be mystical and to go beyond what can be thought about.
Mm-hmm.
They think, in general, that the point of philosophy, at least in the first instance, is to understand the realm of intellect,
mm-hmm.
which for them is the most kind of rational thing there is. Okay, so it's characterized by order, by definition, by interrelations between forms, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And then they want to say that realm of rationality and form is a unity, because
mm-hmm.
it's one intellect thinking about itself, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But then, after that, so that in a way, that's sort of what philosophy is
mm-hmm.
for them. And they think that that also has a lot of ethical implications, because they
yeah.
think that that most people are making a mistake by focusing on the body when they should be focusing on this project
mm-hmm.
of understanding the rational contents
mm-hmm.
of intellect with their souls. Okay, so that's basically what they think you should do. And Proclus has different views than Plotinus about the contents of that, right? Because he thinks that these are all gods and that there
mm-hmm.
are many levels of gods within the realm of intellect. But it's the same basic project.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is then this sort of extra thing you can do, which is to go beyond intellect and seek some kind of unity with the one.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a strong tendency in Neoplatonism to think that, in a sense, that's going beyond what philosophy is. So Iamblichus, for example, when he talks about using theurgy, which is something
mm-hmm.
we can talk about in a second, to contact the gods, he thinks of that as going beyond kind of standard rational philosophy, precisely because it's like one-on-one contact with the gods. It's not something that can be achieved through demonstrations or rationality.
Mm-hmm.
And so even in Plotinus, who's a much more, as it were, rationalist thinker than Iamblichus or Proclus, for him this project of seeking unification with the one is definitely the highest goal we can pursue. But it's not like that's what he's always talking about in his writings. Yeah. It's something that comes up very occasionally, and it's something that's hard to talk about. So the one is this ineffable principle that you can't really grasp with your mind, you can't grasp with speech. And so when he talks about it, at one point he says that the only way to get to it would be to take away everything, as he says. And that is a mystical idea, obviously. And because of this aspect of Neoplatonism, Neoplatonism was very influential on the mystical tradition. So you see Neoplatonism having an influence on Islamic mystics like the Sufis, Jewish mysticism like Kabbalah, and Christian mysticism, such as you find later in the Renaissance and so on. But it's, I would deny that it's fundamentally a mystical kind of philosophy. It's a rationalist kind of philosophy that then has a kind of mystical moment, as it were, on top.
Yeah, that's interesting. I keep coming across, especially when with Neoplatonic alchemists, there's in the alchemical lab you have something called an incubator, and it's where they would have their mixture, and it would take months to ferment or whatever it does, cook. And especially in a Neoplatonist concept, they would say this is like the most, I don't know, sacred part of the lab. And some alchemists believe that it would only be successful if you kind of would contemplate God over the incubator, or kind of like meditate, but not in an Eastern sense, but just kind of, I don't even know how they mean it, you know, sit there and contemplate God, you know, try to be closer to God or something.
Or
and
pray, maybe.
Maybe pray, yeah. And it's always in a Neoplatonic concept, and I'm never quite sure what they mean, but I guess you'd sit there and, yeah, maybe pray, contemplate the nature of the divine. I'm not sure what that would mean.
So I would connect that to theurgy, which you mentioned a couple of times.
Yeah.
So what is theurgy? Well, the actual word means God making, or making God.
Right? Okay.
So theos means God. The idea is that a theurgic ritual or object, like an amulet, or maybe an alchemical compound, although that's not usually what we think of when we think of theurgy. We think more of
that's
like,
what I think of.
Yeah. That's what listeners of this podcast think of. But when Iamblichus, for example, who's sort of the great Neoplatonist theurgist or theorist of theurgy, he thinks about it more in terms of like magical words, magical items like amulets or maybe symbols, numbers, stones with things inscribed on them, statues. So there was this tradition of animating statues.
Right.
Like the goddess would start to talk or light on fire or something. So that's theurgy. And this was actually controversial within Neoplatonism. Plotinus's student Porphyry wrote a work in which he asked a lot of skeptical questions about these practices and suggested that probably they wouldn't work, and that in some cases they were very inappropriate because, you know, they would do things like shouting obscenities as a way of invoking the gods. And Porphyry would say, what are you doing? So this is kind of the rationalist wing. This is a student of Plotinus, right? So Plotinus and Porphyry stand for this rationalization of pagan religion, where pagan religion is being assimilated to the simpler version of Platonism they put forward in their works. And Iamblichus wrote a response to Porphyry's questions in which he defends the possibility of theurgy. So what he's saying is that because the soul doesn't have the ability to rise above its own level within the Neoplatonic system, since the gods are all up above the soul, they're in the realm of the intellect or even in the henatic realm around the one, the only way to get access to the gods, as it were, would be to ask the gods to come to us. So this is sort of like, you know, Muhammad's not going to the mountain, the mountain's coming to Muhammad, right? And so the question is, how would you do that? And the answer is you use some kind of appropriate symbols. And the symbols will be things like special words or special diagrams or whatever. And so I think one way of thinking about the connection between Neoplatonism and alchemy, although this is kind of an impressionistic suggestion more than something that I'm, where I have a particular text in mind, is that the alchemist is trying to do something in the physical realm that will allow the divine immaterial mm-hmm. principle to manifest itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think here it's important to remember that the Neoplatonists think anyway that the physical universe is completely suffused with divinity.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So everything gets its character from the forms, which are up mm-hmm. in the divine nous.
Yeah.
And in general, it's not like God is not there.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like we aren't seeing God, or we're not seeing mm-hmm. God's effects as clearly as we might. So when you do something theurgic, and that could include prayer, by the way,
mm-hmm.
when you do something theurgic, you are allowing the divine to make itself more manifest than it usually is. So you could think about it as an alternative to what Plotinus and Porphyry were suggesting. So their idea was, well, we'll use rationalist philosophy to kind of raise our souls to the level of nous
mm-hmm.
and see the contents, i.e. the Platonic forms, because they're yep. all grounded in Plato, right?
Mm-hmm.
In Iamblichus and then Proclus, the idea is, well, we're stuck at the level of soul, so we can use language to kind of unfold the contents of nous, but if we want a more intimate connection with the divine, we have to do something else. We have to do theurgy.
Mm-hmm.
And I would associate alchemy more with the theurgic end of yep. Neoplatonism than the,
makes sense. Yeah.
The kind of discursive end that mm-hmm. you find in Plotinus and Porphyry.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. I wondered if like the whole idea of the philosopher's stone,
mm-hmm.
because it's often by the early modern period, it's often described as gold that's purer than gold. And I've kind of wondered, does that go back to a Neoplatonic sense that it's like it's closer to the form of gold, or is that just...
Yeah, or maybe one way to think about that, which would be very Platonist in general, not just Neoplatonist,
mm-hmm.
is that the thing that is most the sort of thing that it is the cause of other things being like that.
Mm-hmm.
So to put that less abstractly, the cause of largeness is the form of large,
mm-hmm.
which is just the large itself.
Yeah.
Right? So one way of thinking about the philosopher's stone might be, well, it's the sort of essence of gold,
yep.
physically realized now instead of mm-hmm. being a form. But that just means it's the thing that can turn other things gold.
Yeah.
Right. That's a very Platonist thought.
Okay, that's interesting.
Right?
Yeah,
because
okay.
They tend to link the idea of the core essence of something with the cause of other things sharing mm-hmm. its properties. So even the soul, for example, mm-hmm. is alive and gives life to the body.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, in general, they'll say, well, you know, the paradigmatic case of X will be the cause of other things being X. That's,
mm-hmm.
in a way, the most Platonic thought there is.
Yeah, okay.
And so in a way, that what you just said about the Philosopher's Stone could be an illustration of that.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah. I've been meaning to ask you that. That's great. Yeah. While I still have you here, is there anything else that you could say that has a connection between alchemy and Neoplatonism in general? Or
yeah, so one thing is that there are actually some authors who are considered to be Neoplatonists and alchemists.
Yep.
Actually, the best example is someone named Stephanus of Alexandria, who's
mm-hmm.
one of these people I mentioned earlier who's commenting on Aristotle and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a Stephen, or Stephanus, who's an alchemist.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a debate about whether they're the same guy. Because as
okay.
you can imagine, Stephen is a pretty good...
Because I have him on my list, but I haven't done my reading on him yet.
Well,
so
one of the things you have
uh-huh.
to decide, I guess, is whether he gets one episode or two,
mm-hmm.
depending on how many people he is.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's that. But I think maybe more important for the general tradition is what Neoplatonists would say about the physical possibility or realization of alchemy.
Mm-hmm.
And here we need to go back to the Timaeus. So I mentioned that in the Timaeus, Plato is giving some kind of account of the way the natural world is generated by divine principles.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he says, which should be more famous than it is that the four elements
yeah.
are constructed out of mathematical shapes, namely
okay.
triangles.
Uh-huh. All right.
And he says the triangles that he selects, he says, are the best figures he can find because
mm-hmm.
they're the most beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But then he says if someone comes up with a better version of this theory, he will consider them a friend and not an opponent.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah.
So the idea is that you have these triangles that come together to form the faces of geometrical solids,
mm-hmm.
i.e. pyramids,
yep.
cubes, and
mm-hmm.
so on, which is why we call those the Platonic solids,
right.
because
yep.
they're all from the Timaeus. And then they come together, and you can turn one elemental molecule into another by breaking it into triangular atoms.
I
so for
see.
Example, if
okay.
you have, suppose that you had a pyramid, which is the core shape of fire, Fire is really just a lot of pyramids.
Okay. Yeah.
Rushing around. And he even, for example, he explains that the reason fire burns and breaks things up is that they're sharp.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So makes sense. Taken very literally. And then another another elemental molecule might be an octahedron, for example. Mm-hmm. And you can get an octahedron out of a pyramid by splitting the pyramids up and then reconfiguring the triangles.
Yep.
So that suggests that you can turn any element into any other element. On the other hand, he gives an account of Earth, one of the four elements, by saying that it's a cube. And if you think about a pyramid and a cube and do the geometry, it turns out that you can't make cubes out of the same triangles that you make pyramids out of.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to use equilateral triangles instead of 3, 4, 5 triangles.
Yeah.
So the pyramids are made of triangles that are basically the left or right half of an equilateral triangle. Mm-hmm. And sorry, I think I said Earth is made of equilateral triangles. Earth is made of isosceles triangles. So half of a square.
Yep.
Okay. So what that means, Plato says, is that you cannot turn Earth into the other three elements, but you can turn air, fire, and water into one another.
Okay. Interesting.
And then Aristotle criticized that and said that you can turn all four elements into one another. And he has a completely different theory of the elements. So the Neoplatonists then have the opportunity to talk about what we would think of as chemistry in terms of either this geometrical atomism that you find in Plato, or in terms of the kind of chemistry you find in Aristotle, where, at least on their interpretation, the elements are prime matter, which is pure potential without any form.
Okay, yeah.
Plus the forms of air, fire, and water, which means that they have the four qualities of hot, cold, dry, and moist. Yep. Right? So I'm sure you've talked about this a lot in your series. So effectively, you've got two completely different models for explaining chemistry. And these then, I think, in some ways become the two options for later alchemists. So they can either think about alchemy in the Aristotelian paradigm, which is to think about prime matter receiving qualities. Hotness, coldness, moisture, dryness. Or you can think about chemistry mathematically. So you can think, well, if I break things all the way down, what I'll get at the bottom won't be some qualities residing in bare matter. What I'll get is basically space that's been shaped in a certain way. Right? And, of course, turns out Plato's right. In some sense, like, chemistry is mathematics. It's not qualities.
Yeah.
As we now know, maybe. But obviously the dominant chemical theory throughout the Middle Ages and Renaissance was Aristotelian. So it's interesting, therefore, to see that the Neoplatonists, because they're so keen on Plato, they actually rise to the defense of the geometrical atomism. So you have commentaries where they look at Aristotle's critique of Plato and say, oh, well, his criticisms of Plato's atomic theory are based on misconceptions, and in fact, maybe he's not even criticizing it. Maybe he's just warning us not to misinterpret it, which is one of their favorite ways of harmonizing Plato and Aristotle. So actually, I think that if you wanted to think about the way that chemistry underlies alchemy, in a sense, and of course, in some ways, there's no difference between the two, right? I mean, we differentiate alchemy and chemistry in a way that they at least didn't have a terminological way of doing, right? So, I mean, alchemy is just the word chemistry with the Arabic definite article.
Yeah, I mean, in the 17th, 18th century, it was kind of the same thing, but yeah, they're very different principles.
Absolutely. But what I mean, I guess what I mean is that there's a continuity between the two disciplines. At a minimum, there's a continuity. And that means that understanding the kind of Platonic and Aristotelian and then Neoplatonic theory of chemistry is really important if you want to understand what alchemists, or maybe guess, since they usually don't say, if you want to guess what the alchemists might think is actually happening at the micro level when you, for example, turn lead into gold.
That's interesting, yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for talking about Neoplatonism. I think you've answered some of my questions that I personally had, and I hope it was really interesting for all the listeners. If you'd like to hear more from Peter Adamson, he has a podcast called, which I highly recommend, by the way, and have many times before, The History of Philosophy Without Any Gaps. And thank you again very much for coming.
Thanks. It was great to be on.
We will have Peter back for another show on about Al-Razi and Al-Farabi. So if you want to hear him again, stick around.
You've been listening to the History of Alchemy podcast with Travis Dow and Pete Coleman. For more information about this episode, and other information about alchemy, alchemists, and related subjects, visit historyofalchemy.com. Find us on iTunes, subscribe, review, and don't forget to rate us. We'd love to hear from you. Send your comments, ideas, and corrections to podcast@historyofalchemy.com or get in touch via Facebook on the History of Alchemy podcast page or Twitter at Alchemy Podcast. Tune in to our sister podcast all about the Czech Republic, Bohemicon, which is also available on iTunes or on bohemicon.com. Until next time on the History of Alchemy podcast, thank you for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.